Okay, good evening, everyone. I'm Sue Hazeltine, the Associate Director for Biology at the U.S. Geological Survey, and I would like to welcome you all here tonight and thank you all for coming to this installment of our public lecture series. We're always very excited to explain some of our science to the public and to interested folks and to explain why we think this is important to society, that we invest in this science and share it all with you. And tonight, we have a particularly fascinating topic, one that people have been working on since they first started developing culture, and that's our relationship with all the species that we share this planet with. And people have been marking animals and tracking them in their sign to try and understand how they use the environment and how they live on the planet with us since the dawn of that time. In the modern conservation movement, there have been many organized efforts to mark animals and follow them in the environment so we would understand more what they need and how they interact with human society. And of course, one of the earliest organized efforts was with migratory birds. And USGS is a beneficiary of that organized effort. And as national protocols were developed and a centralized band supply was developed, the country developed a bird banding laboratory, which USGS actually runs and supports. So we're the beneficiary of all of the bird banding activity around the country and how we can use that information to look at migratory birds. But technology has really moved on since the late 1800s when they started organizing bird banding efforts. And we're now using such technology as satellite telemetry and many other modern techniques to understand animals in the environment. And we're very fortunate to have with us today a couple of researchers from USGS, Dr. David Meach and Bob Gill, and they're going to talk to you about two of our long-term studies at USGS. One, looking at Arctic wolves and how they use the environment, and the other, looking at long-distance migration of shorebirds that share our continent and the Asian continent. So it will be a fascinating couple of talks, and I would like you to think about not only these talks, but how we're using increased technology to both more effectively get science information, but also to explain the natural world to people. And in this internet age where many of the interactions that people have with the natural world are over the internet or Twitter or some other TV or some other media, these kinds of studies really help people to understand animals in the natural world and how they make their living and how that living relates to us. And so it really increases knowledge about conserving our ecological systems and how people and the rest of the world are related. So it's my pleasure tonight to introduce our two speakers briefly. First, Dave Meach. Dave is one of our senior research scientists at USGS and also an adjunct professor at the University of Minnesota. He's published more than 400 articles and 10 books, many of them related to the wolf around the world and other predators around the world. And I guess what I would say about Dave is, you know that TV show called Dirty Jobs? My mother is fascinated by that show. And if there was a TV show called Best Jobs in America, I would nominate Dave Meach for that show. Because Dave has spent 58 years studying wolves. And since 1986, he has been able to work with a population of wolves about 600 miles from the North Pole every year since 1986. So he has a long-term connection with wolf populations around the world. He's been a leader of the World Conservation Union's Wolf Specialist Group for a number of years, serves on many international committees, and is also the recipient of the Aldo Leopold Award, which is awarded annually for conservation efforts by the Wildlife Society. Bob Gill is a wildlife researcher who's based in our USGS Alaska Science Center and leads our shorebird research program up there. And he's been studying shorebirds for about five decades, and four of them are in Alaska. And if you're familiar with migratory birds, Alaska is really one of our key areas for migratory birds, as it serves as both a key breeding area and staging area for many of the wildlife species that funnel down through the North American continent, and also those species that we share with the Asian continent because international migratory pathways intersect. So Bob has been a leader in understanding what resource needs migratory birds who are these long-distance migrators need, and for the last 8 years has been leading a study on a couple of migratory species he'll tell you about, funded by the Packard Foundation, which has found out amazing things about how birds travel in these long-distance migrations over water. So with that, I will turn the podium over to them, and I don't know which one is going to start with us, but Dave?
Thank you, Sue. Sue mentioned that I've been working on wolves for about 50 years, and as probably most of you know, wolves are very, very controversial animals. A lot of people really love them because they're beautiful, and a lot of people dislike them because they kill livestock and pets and that type of thing. And when I see an audience like this gathered together like that, it reminds me of times I've had long ago when we used to gather and try to figure out how we could manage these wolves, and because they were killing so many livestock and all. And usually the audience would be really composed of two types of people, the people who really disliked the wolves, like the ranchers and farmers and that, and then on the other side of the room, the people who thought the wolves could do no harm. And I would be in the front of the room with perhaps some other experts, and we'd be trying to figure out how can we manage these animals so that they didn't kill so many livestock and all. And while we were figuring that out, or trying to figure it out, we never did get it figured out, incidentally, but in one case, a little old lady got up and raised her hand and said, Dr. Meech, when those wolves are killing sheep, can't you just catch them and castrate them? And I was scratching my head trying to figure out how I could answer that question when on the other side of the room, a grizzled old trapper stood up and said, ma'am, I don't think you understand the situation. Those wolves out there, they're trying to kill the sheep, not have sex with them. I mean, those weren't his very words. His words were more graphic and colorful. But anyway, you get the point. But we're not going to talk about that controversy now. We're going to talk about another aspect of wolves that is not controversial, really. It has to do with their movements. And to do that, I'm going to take you back 50 years when I started my career as an undergraduate at Cornell University. And I was hired by a graduate student at that time who was supposed to be doing his thesis on black bear movements. And so that's how I got my start. And I happened to get the early distinction in my career of being one of the very first people in the world to ever paint a black bear. And the reason we did this was to try to see if by marking this animal, we could get reports from people who saw this creature wandering around, and we'd find out different places where that bear went. And that was an example of the primitive nature of what we had to do to learn about animal movements at that time. Now, we didn't paint that many bears. This was just one experiment. And we got some good information out of it. And eventually the paint wore off the poor bear. But if I had to do it today, I'd refuse to do it. At that time, it was fun. Anyway, we got a little more refined by putting ear tags in the bears. So every time we catch a bear, we put an ear tag in it with a number on it. And then if someone caught it, say, someplace farther away, like by shooting it, or if it got hit by a car or something like that, we had 2 points over which the bear traveled. And so we'd know that bears travel this kind of a distance. And that was a piece of good information for us, because before we did that, we didn't know how far bears traveled. So by putting together data like this, we were able to determine some gross aspects of black bear movements. Not too many years after this, the revolutionary, I have to call it revolutionary, field of radio tracking was developed. That was in the early 60s. And it was developed really and published on cottontail rabbits. Cochran and Lord published their article in 1963. The development of the transistor allowed little tiny radios to be made with small batteries that could be put on an animal, and then as they emitted a signal through an antenna, somebody with an antenna, with a receiving antenna, could pick up that signal and could get good information about that animal. Critical information, for example, the identification of the animal, because each one of these radios transmitted on a different frequency, akin to a different radio station on your common radio that you listen to. So each little transmitter was a different radio station. So every time you heard that signal through one of these antennas, receiving antennas, you knew you were listening to that specific animal. So it allowed identifying the animal, and then we could find it at will. Whenever we wanted to, we'd go out and listen for the signal, and by listening from two locations, we could triangulate on it or walk up to it, and we'd know where that animal was, and we'd know again which animal it was. And we could do that many, many times. You can imagine how much better that was than just painting a bear and hoping somebody saw it a few times later, or putting an ear tag on it and hoping it got killed by a hunter and then reported. So in this case, rather than getting just one or two movements, we were able to get a whole sequence, and of course this could go on, and we often get hundreds of locations from animals this way. And this is still a standard technique that's used today. Actually, of all the radio tracking that's being done today, you hear a lot about satellite and GPS radio tracking. I'm going to mention it. And Bob's going to talk a lot more about it. But in terms of all the radio tracking that's being done today, this is still the basic type of tracking that's done. So it has been revolutionary. And as soon as I could, as soon as 1968, in fact, I began applying it to wolves, which had been my major interest. And to do that, however, I had to catch wolves. And that allowed, though, a wealth of other information. In order to put a radio on a wolf, you got to catch it. And when you catch it, you can weigh it, you can sex it, age it, get its condition, its reproductive condition, you can take blood, many, many other things that you can do once you get the animal in hand. And that's valuable in a case like this, because now we can identify the animal and we can find it whenever we want by homing in on it. And with wolves, because they travel so far and wide, we had to use aircraft right from the very beginning. And now, since I started in 1968, we've radioed over 1,000 wolves and homed in on them with from aircraft like that. And once you do that, that allows not only identifying the wolf and locating it, but then course, you learn its movements, and of course, you learn if it survives, or if it dies, you can hone in on it and find out how it died. You can observe the creature once you see it from the air, look at its behavior, count them, look at the number of animals they kill, and look at various types of predation. And of course, with wolves, since they live in packs, you can count all the members in the pack, and in that way you get you can actually census the wolves in a given area. But wolves also travel long distances when they disperse. That is, a wolf pack is a family. They have young every year. When the young start to mature, which is from usually 2 to 4 years of age, they leave their natal pack and strike out on their own, trying to find a member of the opposite sex that's doing the same thing. And then they pair bond, produce a litter of pups, and start their own pack. Well, sometimes that dispersal distance can be a long, long ways, too far to track with an aircraft. And so we then had to turn to satellite tracking. Satellite tracking has been around for quite a long time. The first satellite collars that people put on animals actually weighed, hold your breath now, 22 pounds. 22 pounds for collars that were put on elk. I like to think of it this way, elk walking backwards, dragging its head. I mean, that's what it seemed to me it would be. But anyway, they were able to actually carry these 22-pound collars, but that was way back in the 70s. They've gotten much lighter now and are certainly much more practical. But what those collars did is transmit from the animal's collar up to the satellite. The satellite then, through something called the Doppler effect, locates the animal and sends the data down into your computer. So that we had to apply for wolves that were dispersing. However, there's still the batteries are kind of heavy in those collars even today, and they do have a low accuracy in terms of how closely they can locate the animal to where it really is. It's okay when you're tracking a dispersing wolf which travels long distance. Here's one, for example, that we collared in central Minnesota, and these are the routes it took across to eastern Wisconsin, hung around Wisconsin Dells for a while, several weeks, and all this over a period of 6 months, and then went back pretty close to where it started. The minimum distance traveled here, by adding up the straight line distances between consecutive points, was 2,650 miles in 6 months. And if I had to guess, I would say the actual distance traveled here was probably three times that amount, because it certainly didn't travel a lot of straight line distances there. In any case, the satellite tracking allowed some very valuable information that we could learn from this technique. Then, as you all know now, the Army developed the Global Positioning System. And that has a series, uses a series of, I think they've got up to 18 or 19 satellites now, that send signals out, and your cell phones pick up those signals and tell your phone exactly where you are within a few feet. And of course, if you could put one of those on an animal, that would be very valuable. And in fact, that's what people actually do. What happens there is that the animal wears the collar and the collar listens. It doesn't send a signal to the GPS satellites. Rather, it receives the signals, just like your cell phone does. Those cell phones that have GPS on them, most of them do now, I think, and or your car or your handheld GPS. They listen to the signals from those satellites and pinpoint the location. Now, when these were first developed, there was still a problem, because in order to get the data from the collar, I mean, it's being recorded in the collar in a little computer, but in order to get the data from the collar, you either had to drop the collar off the animal and take it into your computer and plug it in and download the data from it. And that works with some collars very well, but there were many cases where the collar never dropped off the animal and we lost all the data. Another system is really where you can listen for the data and download it from the collar remotely, and so that works fairly well, and then you can get the data and read out where that animal was. And this allows us to get a great number of locations in a hurry without ever really very much field work. I mean, we all love field work, but if we can be more efficient, there's certainly an advantage in that too. So once you put one of these collars out, I mean, you do the field work, you catch the wolf, you put the collar on, you turn them loose, and then until you get the collar back, you don't need to see the animal again. And then when you get it back or when you download the data, you get all these locations. And so that's become a very efficient radio tracking technique that's widely used now for many purposes. You can see that because you get so many locations and can get them in a very precise way, it can give you far more information than just some gross movements. Now, so all the technology was being developed and I was using it on various projects, but meanwhile, I also had a project where I didn't have to use any technology other than an airplane to get to the location. I found a place, excuse me, where I could just sit and watch wolves. But there's only one place in the world that anyone knows where you can do that, and it's quite far away, up about 600 miles from the pole, an island called Ellesmere Island, which is very close to Greenland. But up there, the wolves have had so little contact with people who persecute them that they're not afraid of people. They're so unafraid of people that I've had them come up and untie my bootlace. In 2003, I had one come up. I was sitting on a four-wheeler with my hands on the handlebars. This wolf came up and with his front teeth tried to take my glove off. So it was very easy to study those wolves without any technology at all. Just a pen and a notebook, write down what they do, videotape them, and observe their locations. And that was all going on this one project of mine while I was using all this technology on the other projects. So that project went on from 1986, and I still, every summer, as Sue said, I still get to Ellesmere and track those wolves. And that's what I want to tell you a little bit more about, because eventually I had to apply that technology to this project. And that's the points I'm trying to make now. So we'll take a little closer look at that Ellesmere project. Ellesmere Island is about the size of Minnesota. You see here it's about 286 miles across here. And the wolves, as I say, are tame. In winter we found them. I was on a snowmobile and you could drive right up to these wolves. In the summer, it took a lot of time, but I managed to find their den and watch their pups. Watch the interactions between the pups and the adults and all that, write several papers on that. Watch them hunt musk oxen, go right along with them while they hunted musk oxen. And year after year, it was a very productive project, and I learned all kinds of things about wolves that I could learn no other way than being right out there with them. Now, to give you a little perspective, where all this was taking place was near a weather station at a little place they call Eureka, and right here, and this is the fjord. It's a right here, happens to be shown when its water's open. Usually it's frozen, but in late August or September, it's wide open, and the weather station is on it. There's a dirt airstrip where you can fly into the weather station, and the den that I found was only about 5 miles from the weather station, so this was an ideal setup. I could land at the weather station, keep my goods, my camping equipment there year-round, my ATVs there, and drive out to the wolf den, camp up there and watch, make all these observations, and it was very, very productive. And I learned how the wolves use an area about like you see enclosed here, and by traveling around both on foot and ATV and following the wolves around it all. And that worked very well through 2006. And then something happened, I'm not even sure what it was, but in 2007, The wolves didn't den in this area anymore. Actually, from 1986 to 2006, they didn't den there every year, but most years. But in 2007, they weren't there. And I couldn't find where they were. They didn't seem to be any place here that I could cover. In 2008, I learned that the den was over here, way away from where I could get to. And the only way I could learn that was by tracking them when they did come through this area to this point, which was inaccessible to me. This is a big mud flats where the waters rush off the glaciers and flow into the fjord, and there was no way I could get across it on foot or with ATV, but I could watch the wolves as they traveled and crossed it and moved down in this direction, and I could tell that they had a den down there, but I couldn't get to it. Now, the reason I give you all the detail is because that presented me then with a dilemma. Either I had to give up the project that I've been doing for almost 23 years at that time, 24 in 2009, I'd have to give it up, or I could try one of these high-tech devices on these wolves. And I decided then this was the time now to try one of these high-tech collars. So I chose a GPS Argos collar. That's a collar that I'll show you in a minute. It gets the data from the GPS satellites and then transmits it through the Argos satellite into my computer. To do that, we used a blowpipe. These wolves, again, came up very close. We used a blowpipe to dart a wolf and put the collar on it. This wolf happened to be the one in 2003 that tried to take my glove off. Served him right, okay, to put that collar on. And he was known at the weather station as Brutus. He's a big wolf that came around and was very tame and all that. So we put this collar on him while his pack mates lay around watching us and looked at his teeth. Sure enough, you see how flat they are here, well worn and flat and blunt, and aged him at about 9 years of age, which pretty much fit what his age would have been since I first saw him as a 2 or 3 year old in 2003. And of course, Brutus was a member of a pack, turned out to be at least 20 members in his pack, which we didn't learn for quite a long time, but we knew he was part of the pack. And the way this all worked then is that Brutus's collar collects locations, two locations a day through the GPS satellites, again, just like on your phone. And then once every 4 days, it sends the data to the Argo satellite, and then that sends it to my computer. So every 4 days, I get a download of the locations of where Brutus and his pack have been. So I put the collar on, went home, back to the office, and started sitting at the computer and continued to track Brutus all summer and even into the winter. Here again is the weather station. There's the area I used to be able to cover when I wasn't using that technology. And here's just a small example of the data that I've been getting. In October, this whole fjord freezes over, and it's about 10 miles across here. But you can see that the pack of wolves is traveling across into another island now. This is called Axel Heiberg Island. And no doubt killing muskoxen over there and then moving back to Ellesmere Island. And that's just a small example of the kind of data I'm now getting. I have absolutely no idea, after I left the island every summer, what these wolves did, what they did in the winter when it's 24 hours of darkness from about late October into early February, 24 hours of darkness per day. What do these wolves do? Well, as I sat at my computer and watched, I learned what they did. And meanwhile, the wolves about every couple weeks would swing through the weather station area, and the folks there would get all excited and take their pictures and then email the pictures to me. And I could count the number of wolves in the pictures, and that's how I knew that there were at least 20 wolves in the pack, because they were in the pictures And Brutus was in the picture because you could tell the, you could see the collar. So we were able to get these kinds of photos. There is in the middle of winter when it's 24 hours of darkness, and the folks went out and flashed and got these shots of the wolves. So that gave us another type of information, and I learned a great deal then about old Brutus and his path. And over that period, since July 9th when I put that collar on, I've gotten over 500 locations of where that animal has gone, and learned that instead of this little tiny area here where I was able to cover each summer and do my behavioral studies, I mean, it didn't negate the behavioral studies that they were done in this small area, because behavior is behavior, but in terms of what that pack and those wolves were really doing the rest of the year, they were traveling over this huge area, and it amounted to their having a territory of 5,000, more than 5,000 square miles. We haven't got it all calculated yet, because not all the data are in. They're still transmitted. And even made a trip, the pack did, of 170 miles down here from its main territory, which I never would have guessed, and killed some muskoxen on the way and all that. So these are the kind of data I'm getting from the high tech. And I'm really glad that that allows me to supplement the basic natural history type of data that I've been getting for the 24 summers. So that's the end of my tale. But what I would like to do, and if I can manage this in just a couple minutes, is show you the actual data that comes in on Global Earth, on Google Earth, sorry. And I'm not very good at handling it on the laptop here, and I'm going to ask Ami to help me. But what I'd like to show you is the kind of data as it comes in. Yeah, we just. You can see the locations appearing here. More and more to watch when he crosses over to Axel Heiberg Island. More, this is in October, November. And when these data come in, they give me a time and a date. I just didn't record it up here. I took that out just so it would be clearer. But I can go into any one of these points, and it gives me the time and the date. And many other things, I can zoom in on it. On any point, if there's two or three points in one location, it probably means there's a kill there, and I know exactly where that kill is because these locations are that precise. And this summer, I can go with a handheld GPS and look at those exact sites and hopefully find the bones or remains of the muskox that these wolves have killed. So thank you, Ami. And in closing, then, I just wanted to tell you one more thing. We've been keeping a blog on that project. If you're really interested further, all you have to do is Google Ellesmere, E-L-L-E-S-M-E-R-E, Wolf Blog, Ellesmere Wolf Blog, and it'll come up. And about every week, I make the new entries in there and new maps and all. And you can learn what I'm learning as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. As biologists, I guess like any discipline, we tend to get rather focused and narrow-sighted in things, so it was refreshing for me to hear something about fur instead of feathers. So, but I'm here to talk about feathers. And I guess first, can I see a show of hands, people that even know what a shorebird is? Oh, great. All right. I've got a little primer prepared, but we can make that short. You know, they're aptly named because most of them are found along the shore. Then you get things like this that spend 10 months of the year in the surf zone along the Pacific coast of both North and South America, but then will go up into a glacier mountain in Alaska to nest. And in the non-breeding season, they're highly social. And if somebody wants to guess how many birds are in this picture, seemingly. There are 214 species worldwide. They occur on every continent. They occur from sea level to some of the highest mountains and occupy every habitat in between. They must constantly flap their wings to remain in the air. This is a point I want you to file away and keep thinking about the rest of the talk. And while all can be found along the shore, there are only three of them that can do what that duck is doing, and that is float. They can all swim, they can float for a little bit, but they'll turn into rocks eventually. So here's what I'm going to share with you tonight. It's a group of birds called the godwits and curlews. They represent the largest of those 214 species of birds. And godwits, if there's any distinction you want to make between the two, slightly upturned bills, curlews, down-curved bills. But a lot of little subtleties in between here. So why this group of birds? Well, worldwide, there are only 11 species that are extant. Two of them have already gone extinct, the Eskimo curlew being one of them that you probably are familiar with. All of them have populations that are in decline right now. And most have intercontinental ranges, which is, if you don't know about the annual cycle of the bird, it makes it very hard to affect any sort of conservation measure. You can do it in Alaska where they're nesting, but if you don't know where they go, it's kind of hollow conservation, especially if the problems are occurring elsewhere. Other reason we looked at this suite of birds is many of them pass through East Asia, which are hot spots for avian influenza. They'll come to Alaska where they'll mix with other species, then go into North and South America. And because these birds have these phenomenal migrations, very long, it's hard to do like Dave described using conventional VHF telemetry where you can only have a range of a few miles, you know. So satellite telemetry came along. Before that, we were able to piece together a lot of this stuff, just, you know, things like bird banding, where you put a color or a ring on a bird and somebody finds it. So in the case of godwits, we knew there was two breeding populations, both of them congregated here in the East Asian coast during migration, but then they had very separate non-breeding areas. And even without banding, we were able to piece together a lot of these annual cycle events just by doing surveys in certain habitats and knowing, for instance, this bristle-thighed curlew, only place it nests in the world are these two little disjunct regions in Alaska. We're talking about, 3,200 total birds. That's the bristle-thighed curlew population. They disperse during the non-breeding season. You could drop all of North America in that area. So, you know, how do you go about studying the bird there with conventional? You need a lot of boats. So from all this marking and census data, we are able to come up with things like this. We can draw a lot of arrows that connect a species breeding area and its non-breeding area. But it's pretty hard to do this. And a lot of these species end up down in this part of the world, but knowing how they got there is very germane to looking at some of these things like avian influenza. So we turned to satellite telemetry technology, and we have two options here. They make an external package, which is solar powered, or they make an internal package. Now, we knew these birds were, we suspect suspected most of them are long-distance migrants, so the last thing we wanted to do was throw something on their back that's going to create a lot of resistance to the air, potentially slow them down. So we opted for what is a surgical implant, and I'm going to pass this one around. And if I forget to pick it up at the end of the week, that's okay, because it's working and I can find you. So we would capture these birds. We have vets on staff. We would capture them. They are given an anesthetic. They're intubated. They're given a heart rate monitor, temperature monitor, just like you would be done to you if you had abdominal surgery. The transmitter is put inside the abdomen in a bird's air sac, which is part of its breathing apparatus, but it doesn't impede airflow. And from the time we catch a bird to the time we turn it back and it flies out of its little cage, 2 hours. So you think about how long it takes you to recover from major abdominal surgery. They're incredible. This, you can just see this antenna coming out underneath the tail feather of that godwin. Dave talked about this. I'm not going to go into this much, but it's the same thing. You've got a bird sending a signal to a satellite. It comes down to a processing center, which happens to be within, 10 miles of here. And then that, in turn, is sent to the user. And it shows up in my computer every day. So after 4 years of doing this, 6 species, you end up with a nice map with a lot of dots. Hundreds and hundreds of dots. Every one of those is a successful transmission between that bird, satellite, and the microcomputer. Now every time we get a report from a satellite, every morning, I open up what's called a KMZ file. I drag it into Google Earth. It opens up a screen, and every one of those dots I can click on. And on it will be a history of the bird. Each one of them is given a unique number, so that's why they can tell my godwit from Dave's wolf. It gives you a date and time down to the second. It'll give you a location class, and this is it's an Argos value for how accurate that position is. And it comes in 3 categories from, a few hundred meters. In other words, that satellite's telling you that signal I got from that bird was so good that bird was within 300 meters to several kilometers. But at the scale I'm talking with, several kilometers is good, and you'll see that. Oh, what else? Distance from previous location. The rate of travel from the previous location. Gives you a heading of the bird, hours since the last report. There's a lot of information here. And again, it's with every one of these dots. So take away the dots, run it through filters, different algorithms. This is what you get, a lot of nice lines across the map. Now I'm going to run through some of the species-specific routes. Now, I want everyone to just kind of take a deep breath, and I'm going to throw out your mantra here. It's nonstop, nonstop. Just think of that through the rest of this talk. These are bristle-thighed curlews that we marked in Alaska. At each one in those 2 different dots that I showed you, we marked birds from each population. Had no idea. We just thought they went into that big blob in the Central Pacific. They have very distinct wintering areas. These are all nonstop flights. They probably look right over the Hawaiian Islands and probably don't think about stopping. You'll see why. Bar-tailed godwits. We did 2 populations. We marked them on the non-breeding grounds. One in North Island, New Zealand, and one in Northwest Australia, both of them nonstop to the Yellow Sea, about in March. From the Yellow Sea, the
from Western Australia go straight up into Siberia, and the ones from New Zealand take these big jobs out of the Pacific to Alaska. And there's a whole talk in itself just in these non-straight lines, but think of winds, we'll get to that. So the southward, this is the one that really opened up the whole avenue to all this satellite telemetry with birds, with the results we got in this first southward migration to Godwits. I think there were 12 birds here. Again, these dots represent places where they talk to the satellite. And there are two of them that get all the way down to New Zealand, a couple of them that go up this way. If I have time, we'll talk about that, but winds again are the word. We did 7 females and 2 males. Now, these 2 males are the ones that we did put solar packages on. And this was early on, and this is what led us to really start thinking about the effects of drag if you put something in the back of a long-distance migrant. The females were in the air between 6 and almost 10 days. And traveled up to 11,700 kilometers. That's 7,000 miles. So for those that are not, or let's say challenged a bit by geography and space and time, that's from where we are to San Francisco. That's back to where we are. And that's back to San Francisco. And if you really are challenged by it all, here's some more. So it's northern Scandinavia to Cape Town, South Africa. This room to Seoul, Korea. This room crossed all of South America to the tip of the Antarctic Peninsula. Or if you're afraid of flying, get in your car and go 115 trips around the belt. One of these birds, E7, just literally became an icon in the media and picked up all over the place. There, you know, the first thing one of my colleagues picked up on was this nice heart-shaped track. We were putting this all together about March sometime, just after Valentine's Day. 27,000 kilometers between March when it took off and we got back here in September. Made 3 nonstop lifts: Yellow Sea, Alaska, Alaska, and New Zealand. You know, had we not started with godwits, I would have been ecstatic with stuff like this. You know, these are marble godwits that are, they're only going from Alaska down to Central California. They have a nice circular route across the ocean going south, back up the coastline to the north. Wimbrels, this whole story is unfolding right now, and to me, I'm just as excited about this as I am about the godwits. But from Alaska, one big long flight down to Mexico, Central America, second flight down to Peru, Ecuador, and some of them make a third flight down to Chiloé, southern Chile. That rivals what the godwits are doing. And when I say this is ongoing, I don't know if the date's on this one or not, but this particular bird, this is where it was yesterday afternoon. Out over the Pacific, headed up towards the Gulf of California. It had spent the winter down in Peru. This bird, last week, this is the one that spent the winter down in Chiloé, took off and flew 8,400 kilometers nonstop back up to the Gulf of Mexico, or Gulf of California, excuse me. Okay, this title said the gee whiz and beyond the gee whiz. So here's some of the beyond. How do they do this? The obvious one is aerodynamics. All you have to do is look at a godwit. That creature is meant to fly, but it has this phenotypic flexibility seasonally that it can carry large loads and still keep that very aerodynamic profile. These birds put on the most fat we know of any bird. 50 to 57% of their body mass is nothing but fat when they take off from Alaska. And all you have to do, I throw this out, these are flying softballs. That's about what it gets down to. It's sometimes just amazed that they can get in the air. Now, they sustain these flights at 8 to 10 times BMR for 10 days. Now, that's basal metabolic rate, and that's essentially what most of you are doing right now. You're just sort of sitting there and breathing. It's the amount of energy it just takes to keep you alive and doing nothing. So they're operating at 8 to 10 times that. Put it in perspective, the best Tour de France riders can maintain only 5 BMR for 8 to 10 hours. Adinerat sled dogs can 6 BMR for up to a day. Godwits are doing 8 to 10 for up to 10 days. Atrophy of non-essential organs. If you're a bird and you are about to embark on a 10-day flight and you're not stopping, that means you're not eating. Why do you need to take all your digestive machinery with you? You don't. You shrink your guts. So they shrink their gizzards down, they shrink their intestines down to just about nothing. It's just a weight savings mechanism. And departure of all flights aided by winds. The planet we live on, the atmosphere, is extremely dynamic. We all know that. But no more so than you find in the Pacific, where you just have storm after storm crossing in the northern latitudes as well as the southern. Godwits over eons have figured this out, and they'll just sit and wait for one of these big systems that's churning counterclockwise, moving that way. They get on the backside of it, get all this wind, 30, 40 miles an hour wind sometimes just blowing right up their tail, and they'll just take off with these winds. Depending on the storm, some of them essentially get a free ride almost to Hawaii energetically. You can't help but put a human perspective on all this, and something, first thing you think about it, 10 days without sleeping? Can't be done. Or this is the water bowl. They burn fat. Fat contains about 10% water, so when they burn up this fat, they're getting their water that way. Now, the sleep thing, next time you go to a park or a golf course or something and you see a flock of geese or ducks with their heads tucked back under their wings, look at their eyes. One of them's going to be shut, the other's probably going to be open. They're sleeping half of their brains. They have that ability. Marine mammals can do that too. Interestingly, this all just appeared in a sleep journal where they had taken our information and were using it. I talked about fat. In the breeding season, they're like this in 8 weeks. They're that's the analogy. But the same holds true for 8 days later. They're back to looking like this. We've been picked up in obesity journals now. They're very interested in the physiological mechanisms of how birds can turn this on and off, other than just really running the engine at these phenomenal metabolic rates. There's stuff going on that controls this that they're very interested in. All the gee whiz stuff is neat. As a scientist doing this for 40 years plus, my eyes, jaw drops and all this, but it all gets back to the conservation. And I showed that these birds went to the Yellow Sea. The Yellow Sea is a very dynamic place for migratory birds. It functions like numerous big world-renowned embayments. The Vida Z you could throw in here. These are all areas where our birds have sat down. I don't need to explain the colors are different times of year, different cohorts. But what's going on in the Yellow Sea? There's a place called Samangoum. They have erected a seawall over that area. It's now closed off. This area is dry. You can throw 2.5 District of Columbias in that estuary. And there are at least 3 others that I know of that same size that are currently being reclaimed. And that's, you know, Korea, both North and South Korea, they filled in almost 50% of their intertidal habitats in the last 60 years. It's getting back to the connection with avian influenza, you can see in the red here the major outbreak areas. You can see where our godwits are occurring. The godwits are also frequenting fish farms, which are next to poultry farms. We've had 3 birds show up in Alaska that have tested positive for low path avian flu, not high path. So what all that means remains to be seen. All of this, none of us were prepared for what happened with this. The public getting so involved in this, and this is only, what I show here is what is in 3 years since we started this. There's been a book written about them. There's been a trilingual book in Chinese and Korean written about them. Children's book, their E3 call home. Just to play on one of the godwits that, because its battery died, it went missing. And they were all concerned about what had happened. Well, lo and behold, because we put those markers on the legs, it showed up. And so that's what the story is based on. My favorite, you just never know where this stuff is going to show up. This is Outside Magazine, and it's the 100 big ideas and visionary giants you need to know now. Number 91, the Bartail Godwit. Dawson in the center. This has been a real team effort project, a lot of cooperators, academia, NGOs, sister Department of Interior agencies. Microwave telemetry that makes all of these transmitters is right here in Maryland. Packard people were kind in funding most of this work.
Well, thank you all for coming, and I hope that you will join us again next month when our talk is going to be on mercury contamination in the environment around the country. Fascinating talk about what we're learning about mercury and our potential exposure. So, again, I'd like to thank the speakers and give them another round of applause.